1360 WCHL and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Here's to Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Cameron Wolf about the H1N1 flu. But first, Adam, let's jump to some research that matters. We have some on the flu.
Yeah, you know, Christy, this is a really interesting research that looks at, you know, what do we do when we have all these people coming to the emergency rooms and flooding the emergency rooms with cases of flu? And is there a different way that we can take care of these patients rather than have them coming into the emergency room?
Yeah, I love this because it's really thinking outside of the box. And in this case, they're thinking outside of the clinic by doing drive-through clinics.
Yeah, you know, this article that was actually just came out in the Annals of Emergency Medicine looked in Stanford at patients who were first coming into their emergency room in earlier in 2009. And they took those same patients, and they then created all these types of patients that would come to the emergency room, and they kind of tested them in exercises with the doctors who were at the emergency room.
Yeah, and they then treated them through this simulated patient model of doing drive-through clinics where the patients could just drive up, receive care in the comfort of their car, and presumably without then sharing their germs with other people because they were contained in their car.
Yeah, and they, you know, while this was only 38 patients, you know, they did find that they were, what they said was they were 100% accurate, Christy, with their ability to say which patients ultimately were sick enough and needed to come in and which ones were not sick enough and could be discharged. And the average length of time that I guess they were seeing these patients out in their cars was 26 minutes.
That was the impressive part to me, both of those.
That
you could do it quickly. I think 26 minutes to, if that's your total median length of stay, to drive up, get your history and physical and any recommendations and leave, I think 26 minutes is pretty good.
Yeah, I guess I just was wondering, you know, here you're putting emergency room staff out, I assume, into a parking lot or some other triage, which they're outdoors, and the complexities of all of those things. I was wondering kind of more like, how does this actually work? And
like, are they on
really
roller
like
skates?
yeah, right. Like they used to do at the five at diners, right?
Right. The feasibility and sort of mechanics of it would be nice to see. But I'm really encouraged by the fact that these folks are thinking outside the box, trying to think of how can we see patients without exposing other people to the flu, and how can we do that in a way that's quick for the patients.
And we used to do this, Christy, and we still do, you know, with children who come in with chicken pox. So we're used to kind of like, oh, stay in your car, we'll come out and see you. So I think we're used to this in the outpatient setting. And perhaps it can be used in the inpatient setting or certainly in the emergency room.
Yep. Well, let's move on to the next one. It's about also thinking of different ways of delivering health care. This is about text messaging.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, Christy, I really love this article from the Archives of Dermatology looking at text messaging as a way to try to increase people's utilization of sunscreen because, you know, a lot of people, they have the right intentions, but when it comes down to using it, they don't use it.
Yeah, so in this study, it was a randomized control trial where they took people who were adults, 18 years of older. They had to own a cell phone with some text message features and at least know how to retrieve the text message. So it was a certain population. Half of them got the text message reminders about daily sunscreen use, and the other half didn't.
Yeah, and you know, these were 70 participants, and I think me and you could have participated, Christy, because we both can use text messaging. We have children, and we can use them. I don't know your children are using them, but mine are. And what they found was that the group that used the text messaging were significantly more likely to adhere to daily sunscreen use.
Yeah, so the 35 participants who did not get the reminders had this, they they called it a mean daily adherence rate of 30%, meaning 30% of them used sunscreen. And that the half who did get the daily text message reminders had an adherence rate of 56%. So 30 versus 56%. So the people who got the reminders did a better job with putting on their sunscreen.
And this was in a group, Christy, that was really, you know, they were primed. They knew what the purpose of this study was, and yet the adherence among one group was so low, and even with the text messages, the adherence to the other group was still less than two-thirds, but significantly better. And I like that kind of study because it's simple, it's not very costly, and it can be continued and maybe applied to all types of other health behaviors.
Sure, to think about how can we get out public health messages through, you know, ways that people will respond. And in this case, if you're carrying around your phone and used to text messaging, then a little reminder might make a difference. So,
yeah, I think if I got one every night around 10 o'clock and it said, please floss, I think I would be flossing a lot more than I do. I don't know about you. You probably floss all the time.
No, I think that would help me as well. So,
what's our very next article, Christy?
It's about telemedicine for older patients who are recently discharged from the hospital. So, so we know that lots of problems and breakdown in care can happen when patients leave the hospital.
Yeah, and we did an article on Research That Matters not too long ago, Christy, about how if you got case management for these patients, then there were better overall outcomes. And this is looking at, can you do telemedicine as a form, perhaps, of case management? What else did we see?
So they did nurse visits up to three times a week, and then home telemedicine monitoring, where they had some conversation over the phone about weight, blood pressure, other vital signs, and did that on a daily basis. And then the nurse and the person on the phone then provided patient education to help with those patients transition from the hospital.
Yeah, and while this was really just an observational study, there wasn't really a control group to see, you know, was one way of doing it better than the other. They did seem to have pretty good outcome goals and that they achieved the things that they wanted to achieve, including compliance, and, you know, two-thirds to three-quarters, and said that things improved across a variety of chronic disease things that these patients had.
Yeah, and they found that using this model, and that's what we're trying to do, is try these new models of caring for people, was well accepted by the elderly patients in this study. And from their measures, they called it, you know, positive or excellent short-term outcomes. So hard to say conclusively without a control group, but it sounds promising.
Yeah, it does appear that this is pretty intensive, Christy, and perhaps pretty expensive to do on and to scale this up on a larger basis. But perhaps it shows that, you know, we can have our patients, and our patients are interested in doing things that are more complex than they've done before.
Sure. The last study is about salt and heart disease. So this applies to lots of us who either love salt or have risk of heart disease or high blood pressure.
Well, I was so glad to see this article, Christy, and it was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it's because I think that I had not been on the bandwagon of really, really emphasizing salt reduction in patients in the last couple of months. And lo and behold, here's an article that says, you know, what would happen if we really dramatically reduced the amount of sodium, dietary salt that people take, you know, up to 3 grams per day or 1,200 milligrams of sodium per day. If we really did that on the population at large, what would the improvement in health be?
Yeah, I mean, really, this opened my eyes as well, Adam, to think that this isn't just for people who already have high blood pressure, but for all people. If we were able to change our eating habits as a population to take in much less salt than what we're taking now. So in this study, they looked at, they kind of did a little projection model to see what would happen in terms of the new cases of heart disease, stroke, and heart attacks and death if we as a population consumed less than 1,200 milligrams of sodium per day.
Yeah, and, you know, it was astounding, Christy.
Really remarkable.
The number of heart disease by 60 to 120,000, stroke by 32 to 60,000, heart attacks by 54 to 99,000, the number of deaths from any cause by 44 to 92,000. These are huge benefits.
I mean, huge benefits. And then to think about, you know, what it would save financially. But it was sort of in that realm of $10 billion to $24 billion in healthcare costs annually. If we were
and
to,
that's more, And that's more cost-effective than using medications to lower blood pressure in every patient who has high blood pressure in the United States. So this is something we really need to consider seriously.
Yeah, and that was what was, again, we all would favor things that are less costly, but also more natural. And it seems like just reducing that amount of salt in your diet, if you can do that, is a more natural approach than taking a medication. So,
well, I know we'll hear more about this later, but that really concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we're going to need to take a short break. But, Christy, we've had a chance to talk about telemedicine for recently discharged people that are older.
We've talked about a little bit about text messaging reminders for sunscreen use.
Drive-through medicine to help reduce influenza transmission in the emergency room.
And about reducing salt at the population level to decrease risk of heart disease, stroke, and death. Really impressive
stuff. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, though, we'll be talking with Dr. Cameron Wolf about the H1N1 flu. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Our featured topic today is the H1N1 flu. And since its arrival in April of 2009, we sure have heard a lot about H1N1, but we are excited today to have a real expert in the field to answer some questions for us.
Yes, Christy. We'd like to welcome Dr. Cameron Wolf from the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine to our show. Dr. Wolf was born and grew up in rural Australia, studying medicine at the University of Melbourne before moving to North Carolina to complete a fellowship in infectious disease. He also studied for and received a master's in public health at the UNC Chapel Hill Department of Health Policy and Management. So he's splitting that loyalty there, even though he's at Duke right now. And since joining the faculty at Duke, he's helped lead the medical response to pandemic influenza and runs HIV clinics. So we're really happy, and this is such a timely topic, so welcome to our show, Dr. Wolf.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here.
Well, you know, there's been so much hype, so much fear in the media from the time that the H1N1 or swine flu arrived. And now things have settled down a bit, although we're still seeing quite a large amount of flu. And I wonder if you just might tell us a bit of your perspective of the story of what's happened and whether or not you think that the amount of fear and whether it's been as big of a pandemic as was expected and predicted at the beginning.
Sure. I mean, that's the million-dollar question. If most people think back to when flu would normally come about in North Carolina, it would typically sort of start to peak in January and really hit its foremost sort of time in the middle of February. What was very different about this is that, in fact, we were sitting in the middle of April, May, June, and this first started to appear. So it was not only a time that was very different, but everyone in the medical community was very primed following a SARS outbreak in 2003 and following recent concerns with avian flu.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the concern was very ripe that there would be a large pandemic. And so certainly we were surprised, I guess, when something actually came out of Mexico rather than where doctors had traditionally thought that a pandemic may arise, which was Asia.
And so, Why is that?
Well, I guess originally the thought was, if you look at the parts of the world where you've got really the densest populations of people and the very dense populations of animals clearly intermixing, the chance of coming up with a new viral strain was always thought to be perhaps the highest in East Asia and Southeast Asia. And that had been our experience in the past with avian flu, with SARS, with the Hong Kong flu some decades ago. So it was a little bit different that we actually found something that originated, we think, in Mexico. And so initially concern was certainly high amongst the medical community, particularly if people remember back to what was happening in April. There was a lot of the initial media response out of Mexico was of young individuals who were dying.
Sure.
And I think the reassuring thing since then has been actually when you start to look at some really accurate data, you realize that this was fortunately not the severe event that we all feared that it may be. was
well,
that...
I'd like to ask, can I ask you a question about that? Because, you know, I do think that is a perception, and I think I've shared in that perception, particularly after, you know, September, October kind of rolled around of last year, and we kind of got this sense, oh, it wasn't going to kill everyone.
Absolutely.
But then all of a sudden, I was just blown away by how many people were getting this. And I guess even later, maybe in the last month or two, with really a lot of people have died from this. And so it kind of went like I became less concerned about it, even though I knew everyone was getting it. And now like I'm like, wow, a lot of people have died.
Yeah, and I think that still needs to be mentioned is that at the end of the day, influenza is still a dangerous illness for people who have a lot of other health issues, you know, typically the elderly. But we did see with H1N1 a lot of young people fall ill, and unfortunately we did have some deaths, and that includes locally. I think the other thing to say is that this was such a new strain of influenza that the community really had no experience with this from an immune system point of view, and so it had a great chance to make a lot of people sick. And I think if you just look at the sheer numbers of people who are actually infected, especially around September, October, as you say, the chance of actually then having a number of people unfortunately die goes up. And so we've certainly seen some deaths from this. They were at unusual times in the year, and I think because the media was very primed to ready to pay attention to that, we certainly, you know, unfortunately they were very prominent in the media, and appropriately so.
So when we think about the seasonal flu and the H1N1 flu, I think because H1N1 started and came about during the off season for seasonal flu,
yeah.
And then now we're seeing all these flu cases, and who knows which strain it is. How do you sort out sort of the cycle of H1N1? Of course, we haven't even gotten through a full year, but how do you sort that out as an epidemiologist of what's the cycle and how long, and thinking about timing of vaccinations and timing of diagnosis as you sort those things out?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question, one that's given us a lot of headache over the last 6 months. So typically what would happen is, as I said at the start, there's a normal cyclical transition to the flu season, which would normally happen now. What all state and county health departments have been very used to doing is actually having a series of sentinel sites available that sample patients who would come into local hospital ERs or their medical practitioner with influenza-like symptoms. And people would know that there's many different illnesses that can cause things that present similar to influenza, and there's a number of different influenza types.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
sentinel sites meaning, I'm sorry, sentinel sites, just explain for our listeners, sentinel sites meaning what?
So a number of urgent cares and primary health cares around the community will actually be set up to send some of their specimens that they take from patients to the state laboratories to see what circulating viruses are in our community.
Right.
And so we get a very good sense of what's starting to circulate in the community by reading the information that comes from all of these sites. And so by doing that, we can look at the community and try and work out what kind of viruses are currently circulating. And so at the moment, for example, if you look at North Carolina, overwhelmingly, the major influenza type that's circulating is pandemic H1N1. Now, it would be difficult for me to predict, to be honest, what that will look like in a month when we hit the time that would traditionally be seasonal influenza season. There will be some people who believe that the pandemic strain will completely replace seasonal influenza, and there are others that think that we may well get a mixing of the two. And you're absolutely right, that becomes then difficult to tell from a clinician point of view when someone walks in, because the symptoms may well be exactly the same. So we rely a lot on the testing that happens as a routine from all the health departments to say, look, what is circulating in the community, and therefore how should we best approach a patient when we see someone who's coming to us sick.
I know we're going to in the second half we're going to be talking about treatment and ways of prevention.
Sure.
I just want to, you know, I know you work at Duke, and I know there was a lot of news in the media, national exposure that Duke had because of some patients that had some resistance. And I wonder if you just speak to that for a second. And what did you learn? What did you all learn from that can really help all of us understand this disease better?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we learned. The first of all is that influenza, like so many infections that we encounter, can develop resistance to the medications that we traditionally use. And so we have to be careful as clinicians not to assume that because a drug has always been effective, that it will continue to be so. The second thing was to clearly say that the way that such a resistant virus would present to a patient would be exactly the same. And so it's for the majority of patients who would otherwise be well and not have too many other health issues, influenza will still be an illness that does not cause them a great deal of harm. However, influenza for a patient, for example, who is at Duke and is already sick with a lot of other medical problems, influenza of any type can be a very serious illness. And so we certainly had to go back and look very carefully at what we were doing as an institution and compare that to other hospitals and say, hey, are we doing absolutely everything we can to protect our patients? And so I think we learn a lot from that.
Well, I'm looking forward to continue this conversation, particularly around treatment and decisions about treatment, as well as a little bit more about vaccinations and timing of that. But we do need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Cameron Wolf, about the H1N1 flu. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Cameron Wolf with the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine about H1N1 influenza. And, you know, we really, as we're talking about this pandemic, and pandemic really, I guess, because it really has affected 1 out of 6 Americans and will infect more, but not maybe as deadly as we first thought, but still pretty deadly. And I guess one of the questions that we would like to ask Dr. Wolf is, you know, there are the criteria for who gets treated, and those have changed a little bit since the beginning. And I wonder if you could just say, you know, just right off the bat, who gets treated? And then also the second question really related is, if it's your mother, would you treat her?
Yeah. If your mother's over 65, you would.
Know? There's a loaded question. So, I mean, to answer your question initially, I mean, there's a few people who we consider a very high risk of having severe influenza outcomes. And they would be principally women who are pregnant, clearly are at a higher risk of having severe influenza, and obviously you're treating not just them, but you're trying to protect their baby at that point too. Equally, people who are immunosuppressed, and that's a wide number of our community these days, and so that would include any of the patients who would be on long-term steroids like prednisone, transplant patients, patients with HIV, and then a lot of people who would otherwise have underlying heart, lung, and kidney disorders equally are shown to have worse outcomes when faced with influenza. So they would be people who we would at least strongly consider treatment for. People in hospital who need to come in because they're clearly having breathing difficulties, I think most people would now agree that by the time influenza reaches that point where someone says, actually, you need to spend time in the hospital, they would certainly warrant treatment. For the people who are well, don't have any comorbidities and are clearly coping well with influenza, the decision is actually much easier to say, hey, you're not going to need medication in this stage, but we're going to watch you very carefully. Should you develop further symptoms where things become more severe, or should you need to go to hospital later in the course of your illness, then absolutely we can reconsider that.
That's sometimes a difficult negotiation with the patients,
absolutely,
particularly with H1N1, where there was and has been so much hype and fear about it in the media. But for patients to say, but you're saying I have this very scary thing and you have a treatment, but you're not going to give it to me.
That's why I say, you know, the old, is it your mother question? Because as a friend of mine who I'm their provider of their child recently said, what would you do if it was your child?
Sure.
And boy, that becomes a difficult question.
It's a very difficult question. And I think what you have to do is you have to step back and say, you know, what do I know to be the outcome for this patient if they get influenza? And if it was, you know, if it was my mother, she would be fortunately well and not having any other major health issues at this stage. So we could comfortably look at each other and say, hey, I think it's going to be okay that we just, you know, that you can monitor your own symptoms. the other thing to say is that for the well person who comes into contact with influenza, this is not really going to be any different to a normal flu. And for people, will normally get over a flu in 2 to 3 days anyway. And treating those people does not necessarily change the outcome for how quickly they'll get better. It's a different issue altogether if you run the risk of having a severe outcome for influenza, where we'd certainly want to be, you know, much more rapid with our decision to treat someone.
And so if we just give everyone who comes in with flu symptoms these medications, then there's a higher risk, I would assume, that those medications would not be effective anymore.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what they actually tried to do in the UK. So anyone could phone up and say, you know, I've got flu symptoms, can I have the medications, and we'd be prescribed them. And in fact, what we'll find in that situation is the drugs will become resistant, and we'll lose that, you know, that choice of that armament, that drug for future influenza patients. So whilst that might seem, I guess, to the public to be the easy thing to do, I think there's long-term implications about treating everyone, and we've got to be really careful about who we choose to give those to. It's exactly the same with using antibiotics if you've got a cold. The majority of people will actually do really well without needing them, and you've got to carefully choose the person who you choose to treat.
Let me ask you a question, you know, about the ways we can prevent it. And obviously, you know, we now have a supply of vaccination just at the time when it seemed like the disease was ratcheting down. And so you had this large supply, and now people are saying, well, I may not need it. Can you address the effectiveness of the H1N1 vaccination in preventing H1N1? And then also, what do we know about ways that we can really ratchet up the coverage of that? And finally, I guess, does the regular flu vaccine give you any protection against H1N1?
So the regular flu is not felt to give you any meaningful protection against H1N1. That's not to say that people should not get it this year, because, as I mentioned, we're still coming up to our normal flu season, and there's a reasonable likelihood that there'll be plenty of seasonal regular flu around, so that should still be encouraged. In terms of the efficacy or the effectiveness of the H1N1 vaccine, it's actually felt to be very good. The reason being is that it's been matched precisely to the strain that's been circulating. There's been no significant variation in that. So it's felt to be quite accurate, if you will, for this flu season. Typical vaccines have a real variation in how effective they are for influenza, but this one is felt to be very accurate. In terms of, you know, is it still appropriate to give people the vaccine at this stage? I think the answer is clearly yes. Certainly if you're in a high-risk group and you know you've got underlying illness, we're still seeing cases of H1N1 arrive at Duke, some of whom are very sick, and I'm sure that's the same in UNC. And I think there is still the possibility that we'll get a real third surge in flu cases that might start happening in February. And I think, you know, in preparation for that, it's a safe vaccine. We know it's effective. And if you think you're at risk, then certainly you should go ahead and vaccinate yourself.
So depending on the time of when H1N1, once you're a year or two in this and can kind of get a sense of the cycle, might the time we get vaccinated for H1N1 change? Right now, people are mostly getting H1N1 and seasonal flu together or around the same time. But yet, this H1N1 may be peaking more in the late spring or summer, and will it cover us for that full year, or will there be recommendations to perhaps get a booster mid-year or something?
So I think at this stage it's felt that it will cover us for the whole year. There's many predictions that would actually say that H1N1 will simply become one of the regular circulating flu strains come the next winter. Mm-hmm. And that, whilst I'm not privy to the CDC who make this decision, I suspect what will probably happen is that H1N1 will be incorporated into the seasonal flu vaccine for next year.
Lovely.
So you'll probably actually just need to get one booster shot, and that will cover all of the circulating strains that will be coming around. We would have loved to do that this year, but because of the timing of this, the seasonal flu vaccine had already been manufactured. Then H1N1 arrived, and we felt necessary to actually create a second vaccine.
Well, you know, it's interesting because One quick question. I've had so many patients who have accepted the regular flu vaccine, but declined the H1N1, and no matter what I do,
absolutely.
It's this fear of that. Do you think that combining them would eliminate that? And then how do you deal with the fear?
Well, I think it really would eliminate that. Dealing with the fear has been tough. What I've told patients who I see is to say, look, the manufacturing process, the chemicals that are inside this vaccine are identical to a seasonal flu shot. And I simply tell them the story that it's that you know, it would have been the same vaccine had timing not allowed this virus to appear on us at such an early time in the year. So, and we've also looked at safety data that says that really it's exactly the same as a routine flu shot, and that's very reassuring.
So what else should we be, I mean, in terms of take-home messages, we'd be remiss to not mention hand washing.
Absolutely.
What are your other take-home messages to people to prevent both strains of flu?
Yeah, no, I think both strains of flu, simply, if you become sick, number one, you actually need to take the credit to stay home. That's hard. We all want to go to work, but it's absolutely the time when you're going to make some of your colleagues sick. Number two, certainly hand washing is pretty critical. Thirdly, actually the biggest thing you can do is vaccinate yourself. It's overwhelmingly the best protectant. I think the other message is about, you know, careful hand washing, avoiding people in crowded places who are sick. They're all important, but actually vaccine is the best thing we can do.
Fantastic.
Or get rid of the fear.
Absolutely.
Well, we really appreciate you being with us today and offering your expertise and perspective about this. Is there anything up and coming that we should be looking forward in any sort of new area of research or questions that are almost about to be answered?
I think the main one is how do we message these things to the public a little bit better? We've learned a lot this year in terms of informing the public. It was almost sort of the first pandemic of the Twitter age, someone once told me. And learning how to interact and explain to people what's actually going on in real time has been something that I think we've learned a lot from. And hopefully next time it'll be much easier.
Maybe we can get Mike Krzyzewski and Roy Williams to jointly come together and advocate for this, because I think this is one of those things that we all could agree on easily.
Completely.
All right. Well, thank you again for being with us.
No problem.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Cameron Wolf of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Duke University School of Medicine. And we have to take a break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes in listening to your health questions, experiences, and attitudes.
We want you to write us about your experiences and share your questions, and we will try to address these on an upcoming show, at least give you our thoughts and opinions. We want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And now, we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Julie Steiner, to tell us what is our first house call.
Dear Dr. Page and Dr. Goldstein, I'm a 30-year-old woman, and I've been taking prescription Prilosec for my reflux for about 6 months. And during that time, I've gained about 12 pounds. I haven't changed anything else. If anything, I'm eating healthier, smaller meals, and I continue to exercise 3 to 4 times a week. Could the weight gain be a side effect of the medication?
That's a really tough one, because, sure, weight gain is a possibility from lots of medications and certainly possible from Prilosec, although it's not a common complaint that I hear from patients.
Yeah, you know, first off, we should say congratulations for making some lifestyle changes, which maybe are helping your reflux, but also seems to be maybe making you feel better. And I'm sorry that you've gained weight if you didn't want to gain weight, though.
It is possible that these dietary changes that you've made, although they sounds like it's healthier, smaller meals, it's possible that if you were writing it down, that maybe the smaller, more frequent meals, if you are having more frequent meals, are increasing your overall calories, or that there are other factors contributing to this. And I would recommend that you write down your dietary intake and your exercise amount in a journal to sort of help you gather more information.
Yeah, and the other thing, Christy, I think we could probably say is, you know, if you really think a medicine's causing this, and it seems to have started right after you started the medicine, then you would be okay to probably try a different medicine, because there's lots of other medicines that might be beneficial to you, particularly since you made lifestyle changes, things like over-the-counter Zantac or Tums or some other sorts of medicines that can reduce acid.
Sure. And I mean, it's also possible with the lifestyle changes that you don't need the medicine anymore. So it's worth trying to come off of it for that reason as well. Julie, what do we have next?
I have excessively dry skin that is especially bad in the winter. I feel like I've cut out any possible irritants like certain fabrics and soaps, but nothing seems to help, and the itching is horrible. I've used a few creams and prescriptions, but they only provide short-term relief. Can you tell me if there are any dietary approaches or other lifestyle changes that can help with dry skin?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. That's a great question, particularly this time of year with all of the problems, you know, we're seeing. And I have the same sorts of problems that our caller has.
I do as well. It's something about that dry heat that we're exposed to in the winter and being more indoors that tends to dry out our skin more.
And the dry air all around us, too.
Absolutely. So, I mean, in terms of dietary recommendations, assuming this is straightforward dry skin, really would be to focus on your fluid intake, because when you're hydrating your body, that also goes through to hydrate your skin as well.
Yeah, and one thing outside of the dietary, Christy, that a lot of people don't really understand, that they say they've tried creams or lotions or ointments or things like that on their skin. First off, you know, grease is peace here. You know, you've got to use moisturizing, and the more, the better, the thicker, the gooier, the more it's going to be hydrating. And for that matter, creams are better than lotions, and ointments are better than creams in terms of their lubricating ability. And so I'd encourage you to use some sort of ointment or cream three times a day to your entire body.
And that's hard to do, but if you do that, I mean, it would be uncommon to not get a positive benefit, to really taking that time to lube yourself up three times a day.
And if you still have problems, this is, you know, where your primary care doctor, your family doctor, can be of help and maybe see about some prescription medications to supplement.
Yep. Okay. Julie, what's next?
Can you tell me if the symptoms of ADHD differ in boys and girls? My 7-year-old son was recently diagnosed, and I have a 2-year-old daughter. I'd like to know what to look out for, just in case.
Well, that's
a very good question.
It is a good question, and good for you for getting the help that you need for your son and for thinking ahead about what to look out for your daughter. That's a really thoughtful question.
Well, I know that ADHD is diagnosed more commonly in boys. I'm not really certain, and maybe you know, Christy, is whether it actually is more common. I know it's diagnosed more common, but it may be that, you know, we're not quite as attuned to some of the more subtle features, maybe in girls, or maybe it's that guys have it more often. Do you know?
No, I agree. I know that same information, that the boys are more likely to be diagnosed 3-to-1 to girls, but do they actually have it more? That's hard to know. There are different ways that ADHD can present itself in kids. So it can be that typical, the one we learn about more commonly, that hyperactivity and impulsivity ADHD, which does tend to be a little more common in the boys, where they're more hyperactive. It's more obvious in what you see, more impulsive in their behavior, quick to make a decision. But the other type of ADHD can be more of inattention or disorganization. And this may be more common in girls, where it's not like they're bouncing around the room, but that they may have trouble keeping organized or packing their backpack or sort of paying attention in class.
And that would be a more subtle findings that you wouldn't necessarily see until you're into a school setting, maybe even further along. So that may explain some of the disparity in the diagnosis. So it's interesting, Christy. I had two young women patients recently in the exam room for their well physical. And after an hour, Christy, in the room, I was exhausted. And I realized that it was these children who were lovely and wonderful, but they were all over the place in the room. And we both know that sometimes is a clue that you might be dealing with ADHD. And I spoke to the father afterwards, and he said, you know, I'm tired all the time. So I think being alert to ADHD presenting in young women is very important.
Absolutely. So good luck to you. Thank you for writing this question. And I hope that you don't notice those things in your daughter, but it's good to know what to look out for.
Julie, what's our very last house call?
I've been having painful muscle cramps all over my body for several months. They started in my feet, but now they're in my legs, arms, and even my sides. I'm 58 and pretty healthy overall. I take a medication for high blood pressure and a prescription vitamin D supplement, but that's about it. And I haven't been doing any new exercises. Any ideas?
Great question, and we'll need to be brief on it, but my best guess, I don't know about you, Adam, my best guess would be that you may be on a certain blood pressure medication that could be causing these cramps.
And I'm going to make a guess, Christy, that it's not related to anything that she's taking, but perhaps due to lifestyle and needing to maybe do some additional stretching before bed and a couple different times of the day.
Yeah, so unfortunately, this requires a little more of a conversation, but I would check and see what blood pressure medicine you're on. If you're on a diuretic, it certainly
can. It could do it. You're right about that. It could do it.
And talk to your doctor about potentially getting your blood chemistries checked, your potassium and sodium, to see if that's part of it. And if not, going from there.
And reviewing all the possible other things that you may not think about that you're taking or doing, but definitely coming in to see your physician. Well, that, Christy, I think is all we have time for our
yep.
house call today. And we want to thank you for joining us today for Here's to Your Health. We hope that the issues and questions and comments that we've had are important to you, and you can share your own questions and experiences by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And you can follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/HTYH or searching for Here's to Your Health.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer, Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Cameron Wolf. We hope you'll join us next time on Here's to Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.